You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Literary Treks, TFM's Star Trek books show. I am but one of your hosts, Casey Pettit, and with me, as he always is Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. We are halfway through the Invasion series, which is fun. We also have a new book release that just came out recently. And we have a lot of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, we're living the dream in Star Trek bookland.
And you're finally living the dream in workland.
I'm finally like out of my busy season and I can actually read again. So I'm like loving this and starting to get podcasts edited and out there for people's ears. it's great. Well, before we get into it too far, I want to tell everyone how to get in touch with us. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks. That will find its way to us. You can also find the network on X and Instagram at trekfm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. We also have a dedicated Goodreads group for Literary Treks. Join us there and you can see the books we've read and what's coming up. And I did update it recently, so you should see the Invasion books there and... I actually don't remember if I added to my fate. I think I did. If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows, and we really appreciate all of the support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. You can even become an associate producer of your favorite show, just like I am, as well as Greg Rosier is for Literary Treks. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And lastly, please leave us a star rating and a written review wherever you get your podcasts. It's great for us and it also helps others find the show. Well, Jonathan, I don't know that we have any news items today. I didn't put any on the outline, and I did a quick search before the show, and nothing.
We have the announcement of the new Star Trek Picard book about the creating the Enterprise D.
Oh, yes. Star Trek Picard Rebuilding the Bridge.
Rebuilding the Bridge. That's it.
Yeah, shoot. That's the one that did not come up when I was looking before. I don't know if you saw the author on this, Liz Cluck. Chowski.
Yeah, she's the set director that was like in charge of the refit when they were the rebuild. She worked with Dave Blass, who was like the overall set. Like he was in charge of all the set production, set design of Picard seasons 2 and 3. And then when they realized they were going to have to spend so much just to recreate the Enterprise D, they told her, who was someone on the staff, to like she was going to be her baby. She was just going to focus on it. And I remember they said it cost, I think it was like $3 million to build that set.
Oh my god!
Because they had to go and find this specific type of wood and this specific color thing. And they had to recreate this specific thing, like every element of it had to be recreated exactly. And wow. It was the if you remember the the, what is that show called with Will Wheaton that they had running during Picard's? Yeah,
it was the Ready Room.
Ready Room, yeah. On the Ready Room, they did a shorter version of like a documentary on this. Mm-hmm. And then I know that they had Dave Blass, the production designer, did a lot of interviews during and after the show came out. So there's a lot of that information is going to be in this. But I'm not a like a production design person. I'm actually interested in this one because this is like a production design I was like really excited about.
Yeah. Well, it's just, yeah, it's cool because it's from Master Replicas. So it's not our usual publishers, that, you know, like it's not Pocket or Gallery or
Titan,
Simon & Schuster, Titan. Yeah. Any of those. So it's like, it just kind of popped up on Facebook, but, yeah, I mean, this is kind of like, it's our Enterprise, you know, it's our, the Enterprise D, and it's cool to, since we don't really have any books quite like this from back when they did the show originally, like
right,
the Next Generation. So yeah, so this is Star Trek Picard Rebuilding the Bridge by Liz Klachowski. And
sure,
I'm sure, yep,
yeah,
A for effort. and, that one, actually, as we're recording this, it's coming out soon, so
I know that the Akudas were promoting it. They were very much trying to get people to buy it.
Well, yeah, we will do our best to get our hands on that book and hopefully get a chance to talk about it here. And yeah, if nothing else, it just looks like an awesome book. So definitely going to try to pick that one up. So that's it for the news.
Well, let's not be fearful as we soldier on into the next segment.
Soldiers of Fear is book two in the Invasion crossover event that was published back in 1996, which we remember from last time is 3 years before you were born, a handful of years after I was born. And it spans all four active Trek series at the time, and this was the first series to do that. So the premise across all four books, just to remind everybody, is an ancient race called the Furies once ruled this entire sector of space and were worshipped as demons, devils, and monsters by the civilizations they enslaved, which is why their appearances triggered deep, almost genetic fear in humans, Klingons, and Vulcans alike, and they were driven out millennia ago by an unknown force, and now they want back in. In book one, which we talked about last time, that one established that Kirk previously fought off a single Fury ship, and then this book picks up with the Enterprise D as the Federation vessel on the scene when, of course, because it's got to be the Enterprise, when five ships come through the Fury's artificial wormhole, which they've called the Fury's Point.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess just to start off, what were your overall thoughts, I guess, on this one?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that I appreciated how interconnected it was, despite this coming at a time of pocketbooks where all the books were standalones and all the books were self-contained. And yes, this was a series, but as you and I know, just because something's labeled as a series does not mean it's going to cross over. And so I was curious how they were going to handle it, but there's a lot of kind of allusions and references to what happened in the last book, which I appreciated, and it does seem like a solid sequel, a logical sequel to it. However, I couldn't help but in every element of the book feel it was not as good as the first. Mm-hmm. Not to say it was a bad book, but when you compare the villains, the first book, the villains were very memorable, and their discussions, their scenes were memorable. They were not here. The new characters, like the Klingon that we had in the first book, the general who was like so fearful, was very memorable. And the new character here, Red Bay, I don't think that he's going to be particularly memorable long term. Mm-hmm. The action in the first book, like the opening sequence of the first book, is just something truly special. The opening sequence here is good. It's not on the same level, and we'll talk about all the elements, but it's just, you go across the board, and I feel that way about all of them. And so it is a noticeable book one to book two difference between quality.
Yeah. No, I think, yeah, I agree with a lot of what you just said. I mean, it helps in the first book that, and we talked about this last time, that Diane Carey was one of the creators of this crossover event. And so she obviously had some kind of vision for what she wanted to happen and how she wanted it to go. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about in the first book was how propulsive it was that the book just kept going. This one, it did have a good pace. I mean, it's a short book, you know, so it kind of had to, like, there was really no, you know, no extra stuff in it, but it didn't have the movement and the pacing that the first one did. And I guess the one thing I will say that I did actually that I kind of disagree with you on a little bit is I do feel like in this one they did a good job of explaining. I guess I didn't get from the first book as much where, you know, when Kellan, the Klingon, he goes over to the Fury ship for the first time and he feels that innate fear from what he sees. But I didn't get that as much when, like, Kirk and the crew were trying to negotiate with them. In this one, it's like every time they saw them, and granted they have a fear weapon this time, but just the actual look of them was mentioned every time, like the horns and the you know things like that, just the kind of devil, I guess, look of kind of our main villain in this one. And so I feel like it did a pretty good job of conveying some of just the even just the imagery and the gargoyles, which we'll talk about a little bit too. But so I think, yeah, like I'd agree that this one, it was a good follow on to the first one, and it did kind of miss some of the stuff. Like, I feel like this one, it could have been a little bit longer and had a lot sharper pacing, but it could have been a lot worse.
Well, like it is noticeable that the first one was about 300 pages. This one was 230, which by itself is like about a quarter shorter, maybe even a third shorter. But the first book has much smaller font size, and this one has pretty large. And you look at a lot of the books by Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush. This is very in line with what they typically write, these kind of 230, 240 page, quick, short, you know, I bet the word count on this thing is what, 40,000 words maybe? I mean, it is a breeze of a novel. It almost, any shorter, it'd be a novella. And the first book did not feel that way.
Yeah.
And there were several times, like, the back of my book has like 70 pages of like extra material of, like, they just go right into the third book, which I could have like read half that book in this. But I would have preferred to spend more time. I felt we desperately needed more Beverly Crusher of her storyline. We needed more of Troy and her stuff in here. And I also felt that we needed more of Riker. There is a decent amount of Riker, but I felt those three we could have been plussed up. Like, it's not like they were handled poorly. I just think they could have been a lot better.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the to that point with the Beverly stuff, I mean, by the time they kind of figure out the kind of gas that they need to make to put throughout the ship to kind of help keep some of the fear at bay, it was just like they kind of, somebody had an idea, and then it was just like, next scene Beverly's like, okay, I've made this stuff. It's like,
right.
I mean, we didn't need the whole scientific creation of it, but like, to like, they could have made it a little harder for her to give her some more to do.
Or like, maybe had her consoling some people and you see what their deepest fears were, that type of stuff. Like more of that, I think would have served it well. Yeah. And the, I will say one thing to its credit, the opening sequence with the attack on the station, Fury's Point, that was a well done sequence, and I felt the fear of the people there, and I felt like the empathy and sympathy for the crew on that ship and on that station. And it felt very Star Trek. It kind of reminded me of a blend of the opening of the motion picture where you have this huge thing scrolling through. And then it also reminded me a little bit of the stuff on, with Wrath of Khan when Khan and his crew go to the station. So it did have some of the movie element, you know, epicness to it, which I did enjoy.
Well, just having that crew, we learn enough about that crew, like you said, to feel some empathy for them by the end of it. I mean, it's again, it's not long. We can't spend that much time, but then even I feel like it helps build the scariness or whatever of our villains by leaving one of them alive, but pretty well comatose the rest of the book. Because of, like, he was scared to death, but just hadn't died yet, you know, like, and so that kind of added an element of suspense, I guess, to that story.
One thing I noticed was there's some, especially towards the beginning, there's a few lines of dialogue where they're like, like someone will mention Deanna Troi. And then you'll have Worf go, "Troi," and he'll be like, "Oh, what's wrong with Troi?" And I was why is he concerned? And I've not read Imzadi 2, and I've not been privy to that part of the literary stuff. But apparently this was the time when they were, like, trying to set up Troi with Worf. And I was like, oh, that is this time, publishing-wise.
I had a hard time pinning down exactly when this was supposed to take place. Like, I do feel like it was after Parallels, which is where the real first inklings of Worf and Troi happen, because that's when there's an alternate reality where Worf and Troi are together or whatever. I mean, that wasn't, like, explicitly mentioned or anything, but I just kind of got this feeling from it, maybe because of Worf's reaction there. But also, like, on the bridge, there was multiple times where it would say, like, so-and-so got off the turbo lift and went down to the two steps to the main bridge area. And it's like, there's a ramp. There's not steps there. And the only time there was two steps was in Star Trek Generations. The bridge in the movie had two steps up to the command well, you know, like where the captain's chair was. And so, like, it was just a little disorienting because it happened multiple times in the book where, like, just the way that the bridge was described is like, I don't think that's how that was or whatever. But it wasn't super distracting, but it was kind of like, come on, these are Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush had written quite a few
right, they should be familiar. By the way, you brought up something that, like, it ties into our what we talked about in the news section, and it reminded me. With the set of Generations, how they kind of plussed it to make it look bigger and stuff, that is so baffling to me that they did that. Because whenever I watch Generations now, the bridge feels off. It feels like it's not the same bridge. Because they changed all that stuff with it. And they were like, well, we wanted to make it seem more cinematic. It's like, yeah, but at the cost of continuity and at the cost of it being like to your fans are like, there's something wrong here. When they made it for Picard season 3, they used the TV show version of the bridge, not the movie. And it feels plenty cinematic.
Exactly.
With the way they did it. So you don't have to make it a larger set for that. So anyway.
Yeah. And actually that reminds me too, I think in this book, like, I think they'd mentioned something about the stations on the side. I can't remember. That's neither here nor there, I guess. But there's only 230 pages in the book. Like, well, let's talk a little bit about the Furies. And they have this weapon, and everybody experiences it a little differently. Like, so Red Bay, who's one of our, he's like kind of our main original character here, he re-experiences his parents' deaths. Geordi, he lives through a childhood fire and actually ends up falling out of a Jeffrey's tube because of it. Riker is something so formless it's arguably worse. Like, so and everybody's got their own fears, so we don't get to see everybody's, but I guess kind of the question here is this, like, a clever sci-fi concept, like this fear weapon that they have, Or is this more of a cheat and just kind of a, not like a MacGuffin, but just something that just allows the authors to just make fear happen?
Right. Like, I get it. What I would have preferred if the explanation was more, they think it's just raw fear, but really what it is there's just some chemical that is increasing your endorphins that's causing mm-hmm. that you experience fear that like freezes you in place, but it really is this chemical. Like if it was explained like that, I think it would have worked better. But like the way they made it sound, it's like it's a weapon, but we can't exactly explain how exactly it works, but we know how to defeat it. And it's not chemical and it's not physical, but we're going to use a chemical way to protect us. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I guess we'll go. I don't need to know the details.
Yeah, it was something that it was kind of almost half dreamed up of, you know, what it was like I liked it better. Like in the first book, when Kellen goes onto the Fury ship and he just the fact that he is there mm-hmm. and sees what he sees is enough to terrify him mm-hmm. to his core. And I kind of feel like if this was a similar thing, you know, I did like that they tried to expand it beyond like, well, we saw them on the view screen, but why did everybody else on the ship experience the same fear?
That's really weird.
Yeah. And then they were trying to think of like pheromones, basically, mm-hmm. like because they brought that up, like, is it something we can smell? Well, how would they be getting that here? And yeah, like it was never totally fleshed out as far as like what it was. I did like the concept of the fear itself as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Like I thought that it's like that to me is like what this series is about.
And this is where if this was Star Wars, it'd be so much easier because you could just say they have a fear ability. They just have like a fear. Yeah. A fear factor. They have a fear ability that they can just use on people and we could just go with it. But it's Star Trek and we feel the need to science explain stuff, that there's got to be some side of science explanation. So because this is a Star Trek book, I was like, you guys going to explain that?
See, that's, I guess, why it should have been almost a mental thing and let Troy do more with it. Like, and maybe that would have also felt like a cop-out because, like, oh, it's always telepathy. But especially for these types of characters that are, like, demons and monsters and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, like, that kind of seems like it would fit to get inside our heads.
I will say, at the beginning of the book, as soon as we met Red Bay, I called it. I said, this guy's a red shirt. I said, he's dying at some point in this book. I didn't realize he was going to die Independence Day style, like the guy at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
But I pinged it at the beginning. And I will also say, as soon as the Riker says, all right, I need two extra pilots. I need Worf and I need Red Bay. And he says, all right, I'm going to fly in. I need you guys to cover me. As soon as he said that, we're still got like 40 pages to the end. Yeah. I said in my mind, I said, okay, something's going to happen. He's not going to make it. Worf's not going to make it. And so Red Bay is going to be the only one who's going to be able to make it out there. And they're going to be like, no, Worf, or no, Red Bay, don't do it. He's going to be like, it's the only way. And then he's going to go do the thing and he's going to die in the process. And it happened exactly like that. And I was like, I mean, there's a difference, but there's a fine line between tropes and cliche. And I don't know which one, which side of the line that was on, but I called it so early.
Yeah, I mean, that was, it was pretty obvious. Like, we've got this, like, best friend of Riker's that we've never heard of before. Yeah. And of course, they're doing this, like, dog fight in the prologue, like, at the beginning. I guess that what I would have almost liked is like the character that we don't get anything from is what's his name? Lieutenant Robert C. Young. He's the survivor from the station. Like, if he'd somehow been able to come to, almost give us a little red herring with Red Bay, and like have Riker, Red Bay, and Young. Maybe Young wakes up and he's like, I want to fight these guys. I want to help this pilot thing. Okay, maybe Riker's the guy to go through the wormhole or whatever. But then, you know, something happens to Riker. And then maybe like we're like, okay, it's going to be Red Bay or Young. Like maybe like that could have helped up the suspense. I mean, it was still suspenseful during that fight at the end because like with Riker getting shot off, like, okay, obviously he's not going to go through the wormhole. It's not going to have a Gateway style ending where it's going to be mm-hmm. to be continued,
right.
luckily. And then it obviously with Worf too. So, I mean, by the time the three of them are in a shuttle, you're like, well, we all know how this is going to end. But mm-hmm. it was still a good fight because even it, I felt like it kept you guessing as far as like, is anybody going to get through the wormhole? Because even Red Bay gets shot away a few times and has to arc away. And even the people on the Enterprise are like, what is he doing? Where is he going? Like, oh, shoot, he's making a run for it now. Like, we didn't. So
I also kind of felt, and maybe this is just an unfortunate kind of, what was it when there's something I know video game people call it, where you're like metagaming, where you know, oh, I have this much left in the level, so I'm gonna use up this, like, they'll metagame it. I feel like I was metagaming this, where I was like, this is a numbered novel, so they have to wrap things up, so they can't leave it on that kind of a cliffhanger, so therefore they have to defeat them somehow, close the wormhole, and it's not going to be this group that goes, you know, it's not going to be the same Furies that we see in book three. It's going to be a whole new book. Like, I kind of figured that out from the way publishing works.
Yeah.
Also, one of the things that I thought was interesting in this book is the way that Red Bay is kind of foreshadowed at the beginning with, you mentioned that dogfight. Like, that was a clear writing. They were like, we need Chekhov's gun. They were like, we're going to introduce this in Act 1 so that Act 3 we can establish him as being a good pilot. And that was also me being like, it's good that you did that, but also it was kind of obvious because you don't get any scenes. If they had several scenes in the book of Red Bay, if they had more, like if he had more scenes to flesh him out more, we had the stuff with his parents, but if we had more with him, it would feel less obvious. But it feels like, oh, we need to plant this early. We're going to throw in that dogfight scene.
Make him like the make him like the pilot of the Enterprise or something.
Right.
On that bridge shift or something so that, like, he's not – because he was the guy that was, like, posted down in engineering just because they needed a place for him, and he got transferred to the Enterprise, and he was kind of willing to work anywhere. And to me, it's like, why wouldn't they have made him, like, a bridge crew? And maybe that's too obvious too, but, like, it seems like in this case, it's like he – should have been on the bridge as the pilot doing something with the Enterprise during the fight so that when they needed the shuttle pilots, it makes sense, like, hey, this guy's pretty good good flyer with the Enterprise. Let's see what he does with a shuttle.
And I don't know exactly how many years this is after book one. Maybe it's around 100 because I know
it's like 70 or 80, I thought.
Maybe it's just 80. But that actually works for my argument better, which is, wouldn't it have been awesome if when they hear that the Klingons are coming with a fleet, the commander of the Klingon fleet was Kellan?
Oh.
Because that would have been because you could bring in a character like him to be like, I have seen these guys before. They could do the Star Wars thing. I've seen this kind of raw strength only once before. It didn't. It scared me then, and it scares me now. Like, they could have brought in Kellan, and I would have loved for them to be like, hey, this is Star Trek. People live a long time. Is there anyone alive today who has dealt with these guys before that, like, we can pull on their personal experience? And Klingons can live to, like, 150, we know.
Yeah.
So, because in John Jackson Miller's Prey trilogy, he has several Klingons from the movie era show up in the Litverse. So if they had pulled in characters like that, I think it would have worked well, but they didn't do that.
Yeah. Well, and actually, now that you say that, that would have been awesome. first of all, to have Kellan show up because he was such a good character in that first book. And then especially as, like, an old man hearing about this, and basically, like, we could even get a little bit of backstory from that he had to, like, fight to get command of the ship to come out to this, like, once, you know, like, you know, whatever, defend his honor, something like that. But, like, that would have just been another really cool way to connect it to the first book. There was a lot of good references to the first book, like, nothing overt. Like, they didn't just rehash the entire first book, which was good. But the thing I was thinking about too is, you know, Red Bay, did he die at the, I think it was,
no, he's dead.
Is he dead? Did the place blow up?
Good. Yeah.
Because, okay. I couldn't remember if he, if he ended up dying or if it was left a little bit ambiguous. Because I was thinking, like, I don't think it's a great leap to say that the Fury's territory, the other side of the wormhole, is the Delta Quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably a pretty easy leap to make.
Right.
Because that's, I think, what's going to lead Voyager to then be able to end the series. But if they had Kellan show up in this book, then in the next book, depending on when it takes place, but it presumably takes place, I think on the cover is like a season 3 Sisko, but if they'd have put it in season 4, they could have had Worf there, so then they'd have the crossover from Next Generation to Deep Space Nine. And then in the Voyager book, like if Red Bay had somehow survived and he's in that book, like that would have just really, like, the more than just the Furies, but had a character come over from one of the other ones.
Had season 4 released in 96?
I don't think so. I think it was season... well, actually, season 6, yeah, because Voyager started in January of 95, and that was season 3 of Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine started in January of 93, I think. Okay. So this, like, 96 would have been season 3, 4 of...
That's what I was saying, is I wonder if, because if in the writing, they write the shows a lot, or they write the books a lot earlier than they write the shows, usually. Mm-hmm. And so I would be surprised if they even knew they were bringing back Worf.
Yeah.
At this point, which is why they didn't.
Oh, wait, no. Yeah, 96, because that was when First Contact was out and came out later in the year. And Worf was already on the Defiant at that point. So it's possible.
Maybe
but
it's possible.
Yeah, like you're right. This was probably written in 95 before that. But at any rate, I think that would have been a cool continuity thing. But so kind of a few characters that were pretty interesting in this book, like, and the Guinan to me is the one that was just a little strange. I think she could have been used like kind of like Beverly and Troy. Guinan was used in an odd way. Like, it was good in that, like, her conversation with Picard in 10 Forward kind of before the battle or whatever, and you know, they talk about gargoyles and like kind of theories about why they're actually there and what they actually represent and everything, but kind of was weird to me that Guinan's advice to him is like, they won't negotiate because you don't have your heart in it. Like, you don't really mean it. You're too afraid. You're just doing it because that's what you do as a Starfleet officer. You don't actually want to have a negotiation with them. And I just don't know that, like, I know what they were trying to be kind of profound with some of this stuff, but I just don't know that it really worked, because it was clear the Furies did not want to negotiate, no matter how much Picard's heart was in it. Like, for the Furies, it was a fight to the death.
Yeah,
you know, and whoever died was us or them kind of situation, and so I'm just kind of like, did we just need to figure out a way to get Guinan in here, or you know, what was like kind of the point here?
Yeah, so I agree that Guinan, it feels, especially after another book that we've both experienced recently, it feels like Guinan is just this, hey, we need a wise sage to deliver wise advice. We're going to throw in Guinan. Does it make sense that she has experience with them? Sure. Like, she has experience with everyone. She's just the, hey, we need to know something. We just throw in Guinan for that. And so it just kind of feels a little cliche at this point that they did that with her. And I agree that the explanation of the, is it that his heart's in it, or should they negotiate? It's like they're trying to be profound, but they're not. And again, I think that the first book did have some profound ideas. Mm-hmm. The ideas of, you know, yes, your ancestors were wronged, but does that mean you should kind of do vengeance against them? There's been like a misunderstanding. Should you try to get vengeance today? Like, there's all these themes in the first book that I think are handled well. Here it's like they're trying, but it's not just not as good as I think they could have been.
And I'd kind of argue the same thing with Worf even. I just don't know that they quite got Worf right because he, you know, the Klingons in the first book were afraid.
Yeah.
And Kellan especially because of what he witnessed when he was beamed over accidentally to the Fury ship. In this one, Worf is just a victim of the fear weapon, just like everybody else. And he... Again, it's another place where I feel like they're trying to be profound about, with Worf, like, he has to go back, like, in the heat of battle, he has to take a second to go to his quarters to touch a Bat'leth, to then basically say, okay, I've now confronted my fear, so it can't control me now. And I'm just like, I mean... Like, we've seen Worf in a lot worse situations, both before this and after. I mean, like, to me, that almost diminished the character. Like, not that he shouldn't have felt the fear. Like, I know we were trying to say, like, look, this weapon's even impactful on Klingons and makes them shake in their boots or whatever. But, like, just this, it was just kind of another kind of like, okay, we need to resolve this and get Worf back up on his feet and just... basically almost like make him immune to this weapon just because he's now supposedly confronted his fear. It's just kind of, it was a little weird.
I will say that Data had being the lifeline, needing to take command because he's the only one thinking clearly, reminded me of a Voyager episode. It reminded me, if you remember, of the Voyager episode where everybody has to go in, they have to go in like the cryo tubes or something because there's some disease or something. But because of her nanotechnology and the nanoprobes, 7 of 9 is the only one. So she has to be alone on the ship and she alone has to steer it and do all this stuff. It's a weird episode. It's a weird episode.
It's but trippy.
This kind of reminded me of that on a very, very, very small scale.
Yeah. Well, and it's just kind of, it's the old trope of like, I mean, how many times during the series did Picard tell Data, like, okay, I'm going to rely on you for this because you're not going to be affected by that. It's like, okay, we've seen that before. Actually, what would have been kind of cool is if Data was affected, like all of a sudden he felt the emotions and like was feeling fear, because this would have been after Descent when he got to feel emotions from Lore. I'm assuming this would have been after that episode, but that would have been kind of neat because we knew... that, and they could even explain that, like, you know, my brother Lore, like, I've got the emotion chip, but it's not in, and so, like, how am I feeling this fear, and how to overcome that?
What if it was like it turned on the emotion chip, like this fear weapon had the ability to trigger it even on him, like they can even get androids.
Yeah,
that would have been funny.
That's kind of like what happened to Lore to Data during Descent, when Laura like lifted up his fingernail and did something to Data. Yeah, like that would have been awesome. We're just gonna rewrite the book now.
Yep.
Well, by the end of the book here, rather than surrender, the remaining ships, the Fury ships, blow themselves up, and Troy explains that as prisoners, the Furies would just be defeated aliens, but as demons, they were all powerful and they died knowing their people are gonna try again. And so I guess the question I came up with is, are they tragic, pathetic, or terrifying? And does this deliberately unresolved ending work for like a part two in this crossover event? I mean, I would say like, yes, it works because we know there's two more books coming. So we can't have what are they just going to fly off and we're not going to see them? Like, of course they have to end. But, you know, I mean, to me personally, I felt this made them, the Furies as a species, a little bit more terrifying, just knowing that they're like literally willing to sacrifice themselves because there's more of them to come.
Right.
And they're just going to come later. I don't think it makes them tragic at this point, just because they've got that kind of one track mind of like, we're coming to get you, rather than in the first book where it was like, hey, we used to be here, we were out, and now we want to get back at you to get back in. Like, that was a little bit more tragic. Now I feel like they've just got full hatred behind them.
I think it's serviceable for the story that needed to be told. It doesn't work great, but it it works for what for okay, that's how we end it. That's how we don't have a resolution. This is how they do it in such a way that if someone was just reading through the numbered Next Generation books, they could read this and not feel lost and off feel, hey, we're missing something here. Like, this works as its own while also being part of the series.
Yeah.
So I think that's why they did it that way. And it was kind of interesting that they blew themselves up, but the problem was I didn't feel anything for the Furies this time. When the Furies died, because of the connection that Bones and Kirk had made with them and how they had been so close to a peace deal, and then that turn where they realized you humans are the reason for why we were banished or whatever. Because we had that emotional connection when those characters were blown up by Kirk and their crew, I felt empathy. This time I was like, oh well.
Yeah.
The villains died. At least our crew's safe this time. Yeah. And again, there's nothing bad or incompetent in the way it was written. It's just not amazing.
Yeah. It's just like this one didn't get as fully fleshed out. And I don't know how long Diane Carey and John Ordover had been working on the concept before they started hiring the other authors to write the other books. You know, part of me wonders, what if Diane Carey had written all of the books? I don't think she really ever, I don't know if she ever wrote a Voyager book. If she did, it was like a novelization or something, probably.
She did do the novelization of the Endgame.
Caretaker? Oh, of Endgame, which hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
So she dabbled in the other series. I mean, the original series was really her thing, but it just kind of makes me wonder, like, as we get into the next couple books, how fleshed out those stories are going to be. Because this one, it could have been longer. I think with more development of some of the storylines and stuff, not just with what we got just to fill space.
I will say, I think the next one is the longest. I think three and four are longer than one and two.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, four has a job to wrap everything up, and then three, it's called Time's Enemy, so there's got to be some sort of time travel or something, I would assume.
Maybe.
Which actually kind of makes sense that they would have to go back in time. Maybe they go back in time, is my prediction. And I've read it years ago. I have zero recollection. But my prediction is that they're going to go back in time to when the Furies ruled this part of the galaxy. To then kind of corroborate some of that story. I don't know.
Interesting.
Well, so we're through two of the books. Do you have any final thoughts? And what did you rate this one?
I'm going to give this... Well, I think it was fun in the moment. This is one of those... Yeah, I had a good time with it. It's not a favorite. It's just that was fun. The first book is still a favorite. This one I will give a 3.5. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I'm there too. I think I gave this one, 3.5, 4.
Yeah.
It was still fun. I liked the connections to the previous book. It feels more cohesive as a series than... Let's, not to name names, but Gateways. that wasn't connected at all. But I was hoping I'd have some nostalgia from this. Like I said, I've read all these before, but I just have no memory of them. So it's like reading them for the first time, which is kind of fun for me too. So
we're gonna get to the end of this series. And if the first book's still the best, we're gonna have if I had a nickel every time a John Ordover series had the best book be a book written by the co-creator of the series, I'd have 2 nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice.
Yes. I actually have to look at like Captain's Table. I don't know. I think John Ordover was one of the creators of that one too. Let's see, but
does not surprise
been a long
me.
Time since I've read those too. But.
Yeah. So our next episode should be our interview with the impeccable Dayton Ward to talk with him about his new release book, Star Trek Picard to Defy Fate. And it's going to be after that is when we'll do invasion number three. So we'll give some time before the next invasion book, because we want to talk about the new release. And if we've planned this right, and I think we did, I think that Dayton's going to be our guest for episode 400.
Yes.
I'm very excited for that.
He was the very first guest on Literary Treks, and he's also returned many a time. So, yes, I know you've already finished the book. I should be finishing it tonight. And, really looking forward to diving into that one, because it's got some things to talk about in it for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan, when you are not defying fate or soldiering past your fears, where can people find you?
You can find me on YouTube. That's my primary place for my YouTube channel, Jonathan Cohn. You can also find my Twitter account for not just books, but all sorts of things. Also Jonathan Cohn. And I do the Star Wars podcast, Two Sons of Tatooine, with my friend Nathan. And that's on, podcasting places. We're on most of the places except Spotify. But you can find us on pretty much all the other podcasting, like Apple, iHeartRadio, all that stuff.
YouTube.
We're not on YouTube for that. Not on YouTube.
Okay.
We will be on YouTube eventually. We're not there yet. But those are the places you can find me.
Nice. And you can find me on YouTube at Bookbuster Reviews. You can find me on Goodreads at Knitting Trekkie. And you can also find me on Facebook, floating around in the Babel Conference and other Star Trek book groups there. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. And until next time, live long
and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.